Live from our nation's capital, it's the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop from Washington. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. One of the big things that the presidential candidates are talking about and will talk about and should talk about is how to improve the nation's economy. And you'll hear Republicans talk about, hey, let's reduce regulation. Let's make it easier to pollute. Maybe if companies can dump all their sludge into our nation's rivers and oceans and pollute our air and increase carbon in the atmosphere, increasing global warming, maybe they'll save some money, which might create some jobs. By the way, there's never been any proof that increasing the bottom line of a CEO or even of shareholders actually increases jobs. What increases jobs actually is demand for people's products, right? You're not going to pump out more at your factory just because you make more money and you a happy factory owner. You're going to pump out more at your factory and hire people to make more of your widgets or cars or iPhones if more people want your widgets or cars or iPhones. But when we look at what causes poverty, there's some real clear things that cause poverty. It's not a question of, you know, regulation here or there. It's the fact that we are increasingly criminalizing poverty in America. If you're poor, you're likely to have spent some time in jail. I don't know if you realize that most poor people have some kind of criminal record. Maybe they've been arrested and they weren't convicted, or maybe they're misdemeanors. I certainly don't mean that they have felonies. Sometimes it's just someone with so many traffic tickets that they just can't pay it because they're poor. And they end up paying five, six, seven times what the original fine is because the fines keep increasing. But the other thing that criminalizing poverty does, in addition to putting a whole bunch of nonviolent people in jail who've done nothing wrong but not have enough money. And by the way, this shouldn't really be part of our law. We used to have debtors' prisons prior to the United States being created, but the reason we created bankruptcy law was precisely to say that you can't go to jail just because you're poor. But we do that. We do that by putting poor drug users in jail and letting rich drug users go free, even though a huge percentage of the American population has tried the illegal drug of marijuana, at least illegal in 48 states. We do that by making it really hard to make a living, right? Making it really hard to afford health care. One of the things the Affordable Care Act was supposed to do was make sure that every person could get health care, no matter how poor they were. But half the nation's governors, the Republicans, including in my home state of Virginia, actually, I shouldn't blame the governors, because in my home state of Virginia, the governor, Terry McAuliffe, supports Medicaid expansion. The legislature, the Republican legislature, does not. Because it would allow poor people to get health care. Now, it wouldn't cost a penny to Virginia. It's already been paid for by the federal government. Virginia taxpayers have already paid for it, along with every other federal taxpayer. So it's not about money. The reason why Republicans hate poor people has nothing to do with money. The reason why Republicans want poor people to suffer from lack of health care has nothing to do with money. They would save money if they allowed poor people access to health care. They would save money if they would prevent criminalizing poverty, because poor people, if they didn't go to jail, it wouldn't cost money to house them. And you know what also would save money? A great way to decrease welfare and food stamps and all the other things that Republicans really hate: allowing poor people to get a job. Now, Republicans will tell you they want this. They will tell you they believe that you should pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that rather than give a hand out, you should give a hand up, right? You've heard that rhetoric from conservatives. But you know what the biggest prevention of a hand up is? It's the fact that when you've served time in jail, it's really hard to get a job. It doesn't matter that you spent 3 months in jail because of possession of marijuana, or maybe even 9 months in jail for shoplifting. It doesn't matter that your crime was minor, or you were just trying to get a little money to pay for your grandmother's health care, or your mom's health care, or your dad's, or wife's, or husband's. It doesn't matter. You spent some time in jail. And a lot of employers have a mark on their applications, a checkbox, as it were, or maybe just a question. Have you ever been arrested? And you can understand why employers want that question. I mean, I don't want to hire anybody to work in my auto repair shop who has a long series of felonies for stealing cars. That makes sense. That makes sense. But the problem with that question, have you ever been arrested, particularly have you ever been arrested as distinct from have you ever been convicted of a crime, is it includes way too many people than it should. After all, if you've been arrested but not convicted, what business is it of anyone that you've been arrested? Right? Somebody arrests you, and it turns out it's the other guy that did it. You've done zero wrong. They let you go. How is that relevant to an employer? So here's the thing. I think it's fine for an employer to ask someone if they've been to jail. I think it's a fair question, but do it in person. Do it with the person sitting right in front of you. Do it where the person can explain the circumstances. Yeah, my brother was smoking marijuana on the street in the park, and I was there, and they arrested both of us, and they convicted him, and they let me go. I'd hire that guy. You know? Or the police busted in on a party where a bunch of people were underage drinking, and I was there. Heck, even if you were underage drinking or smoking marijuana 5 years ago, I don't care. It's kind of none of my business. It's kind of embarrassing to ask. You've done nothing wrong that would prevent me from hiring you as my employee. Now, if you come into the interview drunk or high, I'm not going to hire you. If you tell me that you were convicted, 2 weeks ago of regularly being high on the job, okay, I'm not going to hire you. But the point is to get some context, to get some understanding, to know why someone has been arrested. After all, if you've been arrested for something that's not a big deal, or even if it was a big deal, but happened many years ago, you're still hireable. There's a guy who works for one of the Democratic Party, local Democratic Party groups, who I find to be a really good person. I don't mean just he's a nice human being. I mean that he's competent. He gets the job done. When you ask this guy a favor, he's there. When you need something done, he's there. He's extremely reliable. Nice guy. I found out after I'd known him for a couple years that he actually committed some felonies many years ago. He's probably in his late 30s. When he was in his early 20s, he used to burgle people's houses. That's what he did. He went door to door, and he would go into their basements and try to rob them to get money. He didn't bring any weapons. But obviously that's not a good thing. In addition to not being good to steal, he very easily could have gotten shot in today's society. And frankly, under most legal systems, homeowners would have had the right to kill him. May seem excessive for a nonviolent burglar, but that's the nature of the nation's laws. It was a stupid, stupid, stupid thing to do. And I asked him, I was curious, you know, why he did it? And, you know, as his late 30-year-old, calm, rational, competent self, it was interesting to hear him describe himself almost as another person. And he said, you know, I was a different person then, and there was a certain thrill in it. And it's crazy now. I can't imagine myself as I was, but I remember it was just some sort of thrilling way to break the rules and try to do something without getting caught. Okay. So at age 21 or whenever it was, he got caught. He served a year or so in prison, and he's been out, free of any crime, for the last 18 years or so. He handles money in his role. There's never been even an allegation that he's done anything wrong, and as I said, he's a competent employee. This is the way the legal system is supposed to work. That's why we incarcerate people. I mean, unless you've committed murder or some kind of heinous crime where there really is no redemption, and I don't think there's much redemption for murder. But if you've committed a misdemeanor, which means a small crime, or even a relatively small felony like this guy did, is there redemption? I think so. We even call it the Department of Corrections. That may be a euphemism, but the idea is that when you go to jail, it's not to, in most cases, keep you away from society forever, as we might want to do for a murderer. It is to correct you, to put you on the right path in life. Now, that often doesn't happen. Often people go to jail for nonviolent crimes, and they learn the ways of the criminals and become even worse, and that's a whole problem with our system. But when people go to jail and can't get a job afterwards, that punishes them far more than someone who has served their time. What does it mean to have served your time? It means you've gotten a punishment, you've gotten an amount of time, you serve it, and you are done. You should be able to rejoin society. It was never meant, prison, again, unless it's some kind of life imprisonment for murder or rape or some kind of very serious crime. It was never meant to take you out of the population forever, but to correct you. So when an employer has a box where you're supposed to check it if you've ever been arrested or ever been convicted, what happens? If you don't check the box, obviously you've lied, so you don't get the job. But if you do check the box, what happens is I won't say the vast majority, it probably is, but a good number of employers will simply say, oh, we're not going to call you in for an interview. We're going to go with the people that haven't been to jail. But what if the person who's been to jail is the best candidate? What if they haven't committed a crime in 20 years? What if the crime they did commit was some nonviolent drug felony? And they're not an addict. What if they were arrested but not convicted? Shouldn't they have the chance to come in and explain the circumstances? And you still don't have to hire them. You could still ask them the question face-to-face if they've ever been arrested or convicted. But this way, you can see. And someone who's very eager to work hard and do the job and do a good job and can explain away what they did should have that chance to rejoin society. That's good for the employer. Frankly, he gets a dedicated employee who really wants to make good. It's certainly good for the employee, the person who's free from prison and wants to rebuild their life. And it's incredibly good for society. Rather than have a permanent underclass, often men of color, often black men, often Latino men, instead of having this permanent underclass, they can rejoin society. We don't have criminalizing poverty. People can move on. And that's why in recent years, a number of liberals like me have joined in a campaign to ban the box, to say that employers should not put on their employment forms a box saying, have you ever been arrested? Whether it's a box or a question doesn't matter. The point is, those are the kinds of questions that should be dealt with face to face, where someone can explain away what they've done. The employer still doesn't have to hire them. Can still ask the question, but at least it will give the person who served their time a chance to escape poverty in the future. I do think that's the way to go. Later on this hour, we're going to have Todd Cox, a senior fellow at the American Progress, come in here to explain how that campaign to ban the box is going. You don't want to miss that. Stay tuned. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. Before the break, I was telling you about how hard it is for someone who has committed a minor crime to get back into society. I do want to be very clear. I'm talking about minor crimes here. I'm not talking about mass murderers or rapists or people who, you know, molest children. I'm not talking about violent crimes. I'm talking about folks who, frankly, do some of the things I don't think should be illegal in the first place. I do not believe someone should go to jail for a nonviolent drug offense. If you are a drug addict, you are someone, I think, who needs society's help, not punishment. And I've said often that I would legalize marijuana, even though, personally, I don't like that stuff around me at all. Of course, I don't like cigarettes around me. I've never tried it, never will, but I don't think people should go to jail for smoking marijuana. Too many people have done it. It's not that dangerous. It's probably less dangerous than cigarettes. It's less addictive than tobacco, and I don't think we should ban tobacco either. Just don't smoke in my house. And there are drugs that are more severe, I don't deny. You know, heroin or crack are certainly very addictive. But we could, even if we had to, put people in lockup treatment centers, in rehab, in ways to correct them, in ways to get rid of the bad habit and get them back in society. They certainly shouldn't go to prison. But a lot of people who've gone to jail for these crimes, and let's face it, there's a racial disparity here. White people use marijuana every bit as much as black people. But the white people don't go to jail. Some of this has to do with poverty. Poor people tend to buy drugs and use drugs on the street. They can't do it in their homes. That's their place. That's where they go. You know, there's their moms at home, and it's a one-room house. Rich white kids, or even middle-class white kids, will go to their friend's house to smoke a little weed, do it in the basement. Mom doesn't find out, and they don't get caught. They might go to a friend's house at a party. Some of this is not racism. Some of this is just it's easier for the police officers to stop people using drugs on the street than it is in private homes. The Fourth Amendment. You got to get a warrant to go into a private home. But the point is that even though blacks and whites are committing the same crime, which I don't think should be a crime, blacks are disproportionately punished. Actually, poor people are disproportionately punished. Latinos are disproportionately punished. And they go to jail. And that's not the worst of it. Again, the white kid might plea it down and pay for go to community service and pay a fine or something. But it's not the worst of it. Going to jail is not the worst of it. The worst of it is that black mark, pardon the terrible pun, that stigma on your record that you've gone to jail can follow you for life. Got a marijuana conviction in 1983, and 30 years later, you still can't get a job? That was not what the drug laws were ever meant to do, even though they are excessive. We incarcerate more people in the United States per capita than any other nation on the planet. It's time to give people a chance to come back. It would help our economy, too. And it would help people climb out of the permanent underclass. This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back with Todd Cox right after this. Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine, reporting live from the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. And sitting across from me is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress whose work focuses on a range of issues concerning criminal justice reform. His name is Todd Cox, and he served for 4 years in the administration for President Barack Obama. He was the director of the Office of Communications and Legislative Affairs at the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Todd, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
So in the first half hour, I was explaining to folks what this whole Ban the Box campaign is about. And you were telling me in the break that the rate of recidivism, the rate at which someone actually goes back to criminal behavior after being in jail, that it decreases over time.
That's right.
What are the statistics on that?
Sure. Well, specifically, there was a study done by Professor Alfred Bloomstein that basically said that after you've been out of prison or been out of a period of incarceration for 3 or 4 years, the likelihood of recidivism reduces significantly to the point where is the likelihood of someone who's never been incarcerated.
Right. Now, that's an extraordinary thing because mm-hmm. we often talk about how high recidivism is.
Sure.
When you're right out of prison, 2 months later, the rates, I think they're over 50%, right?
That's right.
So if you've just been released from prison, the chances of you going back are more than half.
Right.
Which is very, very high.
Right.
But within 3 or 4 years, it goes all the way down to the general population. That's amazing.
Basically, I mean, to be more specific, you know, that was really looking at someone who's maybe convicted of or created an offense involving property.
Mm-hmm.
For a nonviolent drug offender who's been out maybe 10 years, the same thing is true. So what we know is the longer you can, the longer you're out of prison, the less likely you are to be a risk to society, to be a risk to an employer, which is why, based on that kind of study and just our knowledge of folks with criminal records, the EEOC, for example, in its guidance regarding the use of criminal records in employment, said that really should be a factor in how you look at someone with a criminal record. How long have they been out of prison or been out of a period of incarceration, as well as what's the nexus between what the offense was and what the job entails, as well as the risk, basically, of having this person come work for you based on what the person did.
Let's talk about the flip side of that same mm-hmm. coin. As you may know, I'm going to be a delegate soon in the state of Virginia. I get sworn in January.
Congratulations.
And thank you. And in that process, I talk with lots and lots of people in my district and constituents. And I remember a man coming up to me, and he was, I would say, in his mid-60s. He was not a young man. He was an African-American man. And we were talking about his opportunities, and he told me that he didn't have a job, and he said why he didn't have a job. He said that 35 years ago, another reason why I think he was at least in his 60s, 35 years ago, he'd been convicted of some drug offense, I don't remember which drug it was, served a few months in prison, and has had a really hard time getting a job 35 years mm-hmm. later. That people ask him about that. He mentions he served some time, and he was obviously quite angry about it. Clearly, he hasn't done it. He said, I haven't done anything wrong in 35 years.
Right.
He's still suffering the stigma of something that happened in the 1980s. Is that common?
It is. I mean, 1 in 3 Americans have a criminal record. That's 70 million people, approximately. So even a minor offense can carry with it a criminal record that can have a magnitude of consequences. It follows you for a lifetime.
When you serve your time, you're not just serving your time.
That's right.
You could be serving decades later.
That's right. And the impact has ripple effects. So it impacts you, your family. It impacts opportunities for you to have employment, get housing, get an education, as you just illustrated.
When we talk about employment, what about housing? Can you be kept out of getting housing because
sure,
of a criminal record?
Sure.
I mean, how does that happen?
And the president has just actually clarified this, but there had been a tendency, well, two things. There was the one strike and you're out rule. What does that mean? That was a policy that HUD had in place that said basically if you had a criminal record or had an offense creating a criminal record, you could be denied public housing. Well, the president has clarified that now with this.
An offense could have been you were arrested for marijuana 30 years ago?
That's the other thing they're clarifying, that an arrest cannot be the sole decider.
It has to be an arrest and a conviction, first of all.
Correct.
And hopefully at least a felony.
I think that's probably right. Something very serious.
Right. Not that you got caught smoking marijuana when you were 18 and served a month in jail.
That's the hope. And I think what we're the HUD guidance is extremely significant, right? So it clarifies that one strike and you're out is no longer the proper policy. You can't just be excluded for that reason. It also clarifies, as I said before, that an arrest record alone is not indicia of, or should not be the basis for denying someone the opportunity for public housing. And I think it really, in some ways, is predicated or very similar to what I was discussing before, the EEOC guidance in the employment context, which says basically, let's look at the whole person. Let's look at arrest records, for example, as what they are, which is an indicator that someone got arrested, but really is not an indicator of that someone did something wrong and therefore similar to a conviction. I think
and that's a completely separate thing.
Sure.
If I've been arrested, but I haven't been convicted, how is that relevant to anyone? If they arrest me, and it wasn't me at all, it was my neighbor who looks like me, and I've done zero, nothing wrong, not even smoked marijuana, haven't even jaywalked, and I'm arrested, Can an employer ask me about that?
Well, that's our contention, that arrest record is irrelevant. And the from an employment standpoint, the EEOC guidance says an arrest record is should not be or cannot be used as a basis for denying someone an employment opportunity alone. And I think that's it's important to understand that's predicated on well-established 1970s, 1980s case law under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act.
So help me with this hypothetical, all right?
64.
This guy who shares my name or looks like me mm-hmm. is a terrible, awful human being who's, I don't know, mass murder, horrible. He's killed 100 people and he needs to be locked up and throw away the key. But I happen to share his name or I live next to him or I look like him. And they arrest me and they bring me down to the station and I have a clear alibi. I've done nothing wrong and they catch the real bad guy and, again, lock him up. I don't care. They let me go. Now I apply for a job 3 months later, and they ask me if I've ever been arrested. Or worse, they don't ask me. It's just right on the form. Mm-hmm. Have you ever been arrested? Can I legally say no?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that's...
I mean, I haven't been arrested for anything I've done.
Right. I think, you know, I'll give you an example. When you're applying for federal employment, you are required to answer questions about background history, and that's why it's important to ban the box. In other words, ask the question much farther down the process so these things are less relevant. But when you're filling out an employment application for an employer, you're basically saying that you haven't lied on it. So if you fill out something where you deny that you were arrested, and in fact later on they show that you were arrested, you've basically set yourself up for perhaps a separate rationale or reason for not being employed,
right?
Which is why arrest records are problematic, right? So for the reasons we discussed, they're problematic.
Maybe they shouldn't be released to the public.
Well,
maybe only convictions should be released to the public. Maybe you shouldn't be able to find out if someone's been arrested. Why isn't that private? If I have an illness with a doctor, there are HIPAA regulations, there are privacy regulations that say my employer doesn't have a right to know that I have AIDS because AIDS is not a communicable disease. It has a stigma attached. I'm not going to harm anybody. I don't want you to know about this. Charlie Sheen has just shown, you know, you can be blackmailed for this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's none of your business. It won't affect my employment. I don't want to tell you. And if you ask me if I have AIDS on a form, I should be able to lie or not. Let me ask you about that. We'll get back to the conviction in a minute. Let's just say, and I don't even know if you know the answer to this. Someone asked me on employment, have you ever been, are you HIV positive? Can they ask that on an employment form?
That's a good question. I don't think they can, or not legally.
What law prohibits that? Is that the HIPAA laws? That would
Well, HIPAA may have maybe a factor in that, and again, I'm not.
I know that's
I'm
not your
expertise.
I threw you a curveball here, Todd.
But there's something called the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Okay.
And the ADAAA, which expands on what the ADA originally has as its list of factors that or conditions that are considered disabilities was expanded. So I could see an argument that says if I tell my employer that I have HIV positive or have any other kind of disability, and they make an adverse decision based on that, that could be problematic. But again, this is not the expert.
I'm just trying to. I mean,
sure.
Sometimes the best way to understand something is by an analogy.
Sure.
To me, actually even worse than being HIV positive, have you ever been tested for HIV? Mm. Because then you might even have the disease. Have you ever been arrested is absolutely irrelevant to the job decision. You could argue that a conviction may well be relevant and we'll get there, but arrest could just mean I'm the wrong person at the wrong place at the wrong time.
That's right. And I think for arrests in particular...
Why are those records even available to the public or to employers?
Well, a couple of things. And I just want to tease out the problems with arrest records or criminal records in general, right? So one of the reasons why arrest records were... the EEOC certainly said the arrest records should not be considered relevant was because oftentimes criminal records are errant. We know the FBI is maintaining a database full of errant criminal records.
Yikes.
That's
even worse.
Using your example,
I haven't been arrested,
right.
but I have the same name as someone who has.
Or
been.
Been arrested and it should have been expunged.
Yeah.
Or something like that. It's still out there. So we know arrest records are problematic from that standpoint. To your question about expungement and sealing, you know, we're proposing, we have an idea that
not everyone knows what these things are.
Sure.
Expungement would be I have been convicted, I've served my time, and then I get the fact that I've been convicted removed from public databases.
Permanently, right.
Permanently. And that means, I think, that if someone says, have you ever been convicted of a crime, I can legally say no.
That's right. Sealing is somewhat different. Sealing means the record's available depending on how it's designed, I suppose, to certain individuals. And what we, the idea we have is something called a clean slate. And we're working with folks in Pennsylvania on that and some other states where for under certain situations, you can get your record sealed for an arrest record automatically. But a very easy, relatively easy process for certain other kinds of convictions, you can have your record sealed, which makes it available for law enforcement.
Right. And I could see how a judge, for example, you know, you get the record expunged, but then you're convicted of the same crime. They might want to do a more severe penalty. I could see where law enforcement, not even sure about law enforcement, but certainly judges, I think, should have access to something like that, but not employers.
Right. And for under this situation, the employer would not be able to see a sealed record. So we think that's a great proposal. And
that depends on state law?
Well, it would the idea we have, it would be obviously put into state law and would be modified to fit state laws, but the basic principle would be the same. And the good thing about the clean slate proposal is that we're seeing law enforcement, judicial records folks, court folks all embracing it because, you know, court judges, prosecutors, you know, when someone wants to expunge their record, they have to pony up resources to go oppose it, to comment on it. With clean slate, certainly for arrest records, it's automatic. And under certain out of hand, but for certain other types of misdemeanors, for example, it could be automatic as well. So you don't have the infrastructure required to manage it.
Clean slate is a certain amount of time. You served your time and then additional 2, 3, 4 years later or whatever, something like that. You don't do anything wrong in that period of time. You get your
record sealed. I think our proposal assists something like 10 years, which is not insignificant.
That's not insignificant at all.
Well, but
if you've been clean for 10 years, I don't see why anyone would worry that you're going back.
And I think you know, comparing that though to situations where folks have records following them for the rest of their lives and for a significant period of time, I think
my view is you should take the sentence. And that should be the time. If you served a year later, if
Fair
you served
point.
3 years, 3 years later, because if you've served 10 years, that's a pretty serious crime, and maybe it takes 10 years. But if you've gone to jail for 3 months for marijuana, you know, possession or something.
Fair point.
Three
and,
months.
And I think depending on the politics of your particular state, it could be less than 10. I think that, you know, folks are sort of using the idea and proposal and modifying it to fit their needs and fit the needs of their particular states.
Todd, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about sort of the scope of all of this and what it really means for getting people out of poverty in America.
Sure.
This is Mark Levine. We'll be right back right after this. Welcome back to The Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. I'm sitting here with Todd Cox at the Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. He's a senior fellow here. His work focuses on a range of issues concerning criminal justice reform. And he used to work for the administration for President Obama in the Office of Communications and Legislative Affairs. He was the director there at the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Thank you for coming back here sitting with me, Todd. We talked at length about sort of the nature of the problem. You said 70 million Americans have criminal records. That's not arrest. That's convictions.
No, it's an arrest.
Arrest or conviction.
Arrest records, period, which is why it's an important statistic.
What's the percentage that have actually been convicted of something?
Some set of that, which I don't.
You don't have in front of you.
Okay,
I'm just trying to get a feel for it, but it's still an enormous number of people.
It is an enormous number of people, and I think you know, and that's why we emphasize really the one in three having a criminal record, because so many people encounter the criminal justice system and don't go to prison, become incarcerated,
right.
And yet the barriers that attend that are there. And
I do know we have the largest number of people in prison. Not just numerically, but per capita in the world.
That's right.
Used to be, I think, third after China and Russia, but now we're number one in a way that I don't like that America's number one.
That's right.
There are a number of bills in Congress to help make this situation a little bit better. Tell me about some of those.
Sure. Well, the one that's getting the most attention is the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act, which focuses on both the middle end of things, not the front end, but sort of the part right after that regarding sentencing. And, you know, everyone knows the legacy of the war on drugs, where with mandatory minimums, an inordinate number of people were put in prison that probably shouldn't have been there.
And the crack cocaine disparity.
That's right.
This is exactly the same drug. One way you smoke it, one way you snort it. it. Rich white people tend to snort it. Poor black people tend to smoke it. And the crack had, like, what, 5 or 10 times the penalties of cocaine? I forget what it was.
It was a significant disparity. And I think this bill, and among other things, doesn't take care of it completely, but takes something, the reduction in the disparity that was achieved through the Fair Sentencing Act, and makes it retroactive, which is significant. It also redirects the use of mandatory minimums to the most violent, the least...
I don't have the sympathy for violent criminals.
So it really reduces the impact on low-level nonviolent drug offenders. It also does something that was very significant for CAP.
Center for American Progress.
Exactly, Center for American Progress. Thank you. It offers an opportunity for juveniles under certain circumstances to have their records sealed or expunged, and also offers an opportunity if you are a person undergoing a federal background check to challenge the accuracy of that background check. We had talked before about the...
Getting some wrong name.
That's right. Or in a situation the EEOC confronted, someone had an adverse employment decision made, or they were excluded from employment simply because the background check that came back was wrong.
Yeah.
And the employer still acted on it. So those are just some of the highlights for that particular piece of legislation, and that's moving hopefully to the Senate floor.
I assume President Obama supports this legislation.
Yes, he does.
Is it a bipartisan bill?
It is. Bipartisan, and now part of it's bicameral in the
Senate and House.
The House has taken up the Senate sentencing part of this, and that made it through markup today.
The
sentencing.
Congratulations.
Part.
In a committee controlled by Republicans, it came out. Was it unanimous? Was it a majority?
It was a voice vote, and I don't know I don't know all the background.
Well, I'm excited. I got to tell you, anytime Republicans support something I like, I'm excited. I'm usually surprised, but I'm often excited. So this is a bill that hasn't fallen into the partisan madness of the Affordable Care Act or abortions or guns or all the other things that we liberals care about, conservatives care about, and never go anywhere. This is something that really you think both sides, both bipartisan and bicameral, Senate and House, can support.
I think there's some definite bipartisan momentum now for criminal justice reform. Manifested by this bill that came out of the Senate first, significant support from Senator Grassley. We applaud his leadership.
Senator Grassley,
on this.
Of course, a Republican from
Iowa, who headed up the Judiciary Committee. But put together a what they call a gang of eventually 8, I think, senators on both sides of the aisle to craft something that really everyone could agree to.
So this is going to get past the 60-vote filibuster, you think?
On the Senate side, yeah. I think if it gets to the floor, and we really are encouraging Senator McConnell to let it go to the floor and have the vote.
So how do we feel about Speaker Ryan? Is this something that he would support? I mean, he supposedly comes from the Jack Kemp school of really caring about people in poverty. That's at least what he says.
Well, he's spoken favorably about getting something done on criminal justice reform. So we take him at his word, and we're encouraged by that, and hope that he takes up the various pieces of the act that's coming out of the Senate and takes it up in the House and moves it forward. There's another bicameral bipartisan bill that's percolating, hopefully moving to the Senate floor, and also is introduced in the House, and that's the shorthand for that is the Fair Chance Act, which basically requires the federal agencies as well as federal contractors to quote unquote ban the box in employment. And what that means, again, is delaying the inquiry on background.
You can still find out if someone has a criminal record, but they can't just put it on a form and you exclude them before you even see them.
Exactly.
Give them a chance to explain, it happened when I was 19
and
that's 50 years ago and
exactly.
I haven't done anything since.
It's significant.
Right.
That's, again, we applaud the bipartisan nature of that.
Real quick, because we're running out of time.
Sure.
President Obama has an executive order that basically does ban the box for federal employees, right?
That's right. It's not an executive order. And a lot of us have called for that. He's calling for OPM to introduce
the Office of Personnel Management.
Office of Personnel Management to put in a rule banning the box for federal agencies. Not insignificant. We would like to see more.
So it's not an executive order. It'd be a
executive
rule. Would it survive the end of an Obama presidency?
It would. If the rule gets out, goes through notice of proposed rulemaking.
So that would actually be more powerful than executive
potentially.
Order. Potentially. Because it could survive. Now, obviously, a new president could put in a new rule. But
that's right.
At least it actually has more permanence than just the end of President Obama's term.
That's right. And I think the process for rulemaking as well as an executive order, particularly rulemaking where it allows public input and allows also agencies to get some buy-in in the process, is not insignificant.
Todd Cox, thank you for coming here sharing with me and with all our listeners your wisdom. Folks, if you have a state that wants to ban the box, you'll now know what that means if you don't already. Help give people a second chance. Frankly, that's what America is all about, right? This is Mark Levine, reporting for the Center for American Progress, and I'm signing off.